AI is everywhere, and especially in learning and development. Every learning tech solution says they're powered by AI, but are they really? Does AI solve all your worries, or does it just create more problems? On the all-new Learning Uncovered podcast, we'll cut through that noise, exploring the truth about AI in the corporate learning world. We'll look at the real pros and cons and how you can actually use AI to make an impact in your business. So get ready to uncover what really matters. I'm Tom Pope, and welcome to this all-new podcast, Learning Uncovered. AI is coming for your job, or is it here to save your sanity from endless compliance training? Either way, if you work in learning and development, you can't ignore it. But let's be honest, is AI the shiny new toy we've all been waiting for, or just another buzzword we'll quietly bury in 18 months just like gamification? So is AI going to revolutionize how we learn at work, or just generate slightly better PDFs? I'm Tom Pape, and I spend my days with learning clients, learning professionals, and learning tech, which means I've seen enough vendor pitches to know when someone's overselling. But today, instead of me ranting on, I've brought in two brilliant minds who can separate the hype from the hope. Our first guest is resident Canadian based in Toronto with one foot in Europe, Laurie Niles-Hoffman, an industry leader who's spent years convincing executives that learning isn't just about tick box training. She's got some very strong views on AI, and I can't wait to see if we all end up agreeing. And alongside Laurie, we have Carlo Jose, who's been leading the world of L&D strategy for donkey's years. Rumor has it he's survived more platform migrations than any human should reasonably endure, yet he still looks remarkably youthful. That's our panel. Welcome to L&D Uncovered.
Thanks for having us. It's a good thing we're on a podcast format, because no one can refute the claim that I look younger than I actually am.
Yeah, well, you definitely do, Carlo.
I'm looking at you right now, definitely, Carlo, not a day over 25.
He just doesn't age, Laurie.
No, he doesn't.
Both, thanks so much for joining us. Let's kick off straight with some questions, okay? Let's see where we are in terms of AI in today's market. How are organizations currently using AI in learning development? And have you seen some kind of really good and bad examples? Laurie, do you want to go first?
I can jump right in. I mean, the big hype wave, of course, was generative AI. And people, I think, to a certain degree, and Carlo, you're nodding, so that makes me feel good that I'm not going off on a tangent here. But generative AI is still where people are sitting. It's how quickly can I create a course? How quickly can I, you know, build a PDF? Can you, you know, format these learning objectives for me? That sort of thing. And the interesting thing is even when I see people prompting in generative AI, you know, they don't even mention the learner, which I find really, really interesting. It's not even describing who they are. They're just like, give me a course on X, Y, and Z. So we've ridden that hype wave, although a lot of people are still there. They're using it for videos, for graphics, all that sort of stuff. For me, where we get very exciting is in the agentic AI space. And we're starting to see that automation of a lot of tasks. But for me, it's less about automation, just doing what we did before, like taking ADDIE and making it learning out of a box, and here's a bunch of bots that can do it for you. It's rethinking the entire process of how learning actually gets to a learner and what that experience looks like. So agentic is really where the sparks in my head go off.
Thanks, Laurie. Colin?
Yeah, I concur with that. I mean, if I think back to 2 years ago, it was a time where ChatGPT was becoming a bit more mainstream on the consumer side. But I think the fast follower within that is organizations with services or SaaS products that are starting to kind of enable AI-enabled features or AI-supported features. I think my pet peeve is that salespeople think that they know more than they do. And equally, products claiming to do things that aren't actually real. And so I think, you know, if I'm thinking about the L&D practitioner of today, the thing that they need to be considering is where is their own comfort level, understanding, and awareness around what is artificial intelligence, and more specifically, what is it in the context of these products and services. Now, back to Laurie's point, I think there's quite a lot of AI capability that can support the kind of automation of tasks, but there are higher order things that we're probably going to want to chase after in the near future. So if I kind of fast forward a little bit into the future, a lot of the stuff that is going to be mainstream It's a bit like if you think back to Google and search, what they are today is ubiquitous and searching is kind of an easy thing. But even Google is starting to integrate that AI capability to start, you know, using prompts within the search and presenting kind of LLM-enabled responses, harvesting the best answers out there. I think tools are going to start to do that a little bit better. But I think equally in the experience that actual employees and learners are going to be able to kind of interact with, there's going to be a lot of game-changing stuff on the horizon. I don't think we're quite there yet, but there's a lot of companies that are really investing their energies in that space. And it's got the potential to really break up the kind of ecosystem today, whether it's content providers, whether it's learning content authoring tools and things like that.
Could not agree more. And also, Carlo, a nod and shout out for you mentioning, you know, that there's a lot of vaporware tech out there. One that was demonstrated to me, it's standard. I mean, they had a rug of that you could customize, and then they had an agent sitting on top of it that you could, you know, like the LLM experience. But I asked them, well, how did you train that agent? And they said, well, we have a really detailed 2-page SOP that we give them. And I'm like, 2 pages like that. And they're basically relying. It's like, you might as well just have ChatGPT or Claude or anything else. I mean, the experience is going to be negligible because they were plugging into whichever one you wanted to. So why even have that interface? But people were like, it's amazing. It's actually not.
When you experience things for the first time, it's a bit like magic. And people underestimate the depth that you have to go to really properly test something so that it delivers what you need. And, you know, so even within our organization, we're grappling with this. You know, we're testing AI-enabled coaching experiences as an example and exploring that. But also scratching our heads about, well, how do you test this? Against what parameters, right? So this is kind of going beyond, you've made the assumption that, you know, from a privacy perspective, from a data security perspective, everything's acceptable. Now you're into the core functionality of products. You've got to have kind of the mindset and approach for being able to test these and saying, okay, I think we've got an acceptable experience that we can deliver. We're still going to be able to monitor and capture the kind of feedback of users from a kind of usability perspective. But equally, we need to keep kind of watching out for these AI things can go a little bit out of whack, especially when you feed it 2-page SOPs. You probably need to, you know, feed it a bit more. I don't know what the right number is. I don't think we know what the right number is yet, but I think the more the better, because otherwise you're relying on an LLM to fill in the blanks and make stuff up, right?
Completely. And, you know, pro tip, if it, you know, it looks good in the demo, but every subsequent time you use it, it gives you the same response, that's probably a problem.
You mentioned something, Carlo, and you were nodding, Laurie, in the fact that a lot of corporate organizations are slow to adopt certain IA tools because of the compliance, the security, the firewall, et cetera, or in terms of the data, where's it being stored and so on. Do you think that's hampering a lot of organizations moving quicker on it?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And we're no different, because I think the first time that you engage with AI products, it can be a bit challenging. You're not on your own, because many organizations are tackling this. And actually, there are very simple frameworks. And if you take out the word AI, this is just another new technology. The same risk management principles apply. So whether it's data storage or learning management systems, this just happens to be a different type of product or service. You're still trying to answer the same things from a risk management perspective, right? So I think people do get a little bit stuck, especially when you're dealing with a kind of mystery black box of AI and LLMs and how did they get trained. There isn't a kind of silver bullet answer. You've got to go through the rigor to understand, and it forces suppliers to come to the table with better answers, because sometimes their people are also kind of grappling with, you know, I often see this with product teams being at the core of engineering the solutions and sales teams quickly trying to catch up, you know, and it, oftentimes it's somewhere in between where the answers lie. You've got to connect the right people within your own organization with suppliers to be able to have that conversation.
And to add to that, because we're talking about EdTech and L&D is putting people through an AI risk course is not the solution to mitigating the risk of AI. And I see that happen a lot, where they'll throw it onto, just like you would do with anti-money laundering or anti-corruption and bribery, and they're saying, don't do this and do that. I also, when we're looking at these protocols, I want to work proactively with IT and risk and say, okay, do we have the proper infrastructure in place to mitigate a lot of these things? You can't just have somebody did a tick box exercise and that's going to protect the entire company. I'd like to say that L&D is all powerful and everybody who takes a course completes that behavior. It's not true. So lean into those other parts of the organization and lean into them early before you're even looking at some of these tools, because they can guide you quite well.
I couldn't agree more. I think your risk, your data privacy teams, your tech teams need to be with you lockstep, because they're either going to be your great enablers and partners, or they're actually going to stop you down the road because you didn't factor them in. And I deal with this within our business too, not just here in GSK, but in my previous job. People always jump to me with solutions saying, hey, I think we should buy X, Y, and Z. And I said, well, hang on a minute. Can we first start with what problem are you trying to solve? And then engage the right people in the conversation of, well, if we're trying to solve for this, what is the right solution? And what are some of these things that we've got to do anyway from a governance and risk management perspective to make the right decision for the organization? It's all well and good that you see an advert in LinkedIn or even on Facebook, but that's not the answer to your problem.
I don't know if I trust any ed tech advertised on Facebook, but... You know, I've seen it so many times too, where an L&D leader falls in love with a particular tool and you say, have you spoken to IT? No, I mean, I'm sure it'll get passed. You know, don't make that assumption. And the last thing, and I totally understand, is with all the demands that are on IT, coming to them when you've already fallen in love and saying, you know, this is the puppy I want to get, is not a good idea, because now you're putting more work on them. It's best to get them involved at the beginning, have those specs, take those to the vendor in the first meeting to be like, is this even going to be feasible? Like, can we work within this?
It's interesting you should say that, because it's always been a massive bugbear for me, whereas, you know, people generally are magpies and they like new tech, new shiny things, and they bring it in. And to your point, Carlo, it's, you know, I really like this. It's something I really want to do, and you bring it in. And then there's that kind of element. Certainly when I was working in the corporate world, it was very much just get it done and beg forgiveness rather than ask permission. But then it would always get slowed down by the tech teams, et cetera, for various good reasons. And then it would not end well. So it's interesting that kind of human behavior is normal, not just with AI, right? But with all platforms, all technologies, processes, ways of doing things. It's the way of human beings. Okay, great. So really, really interesting. One thing before we get onto the easy part, which is the kind of challenges and risks of AI and then the way we see it, just kind of looking at the opportunities and so on. We talked about agentic and the way that they kind of get baked into the current platforms and technologies and the way we do things as we go forward. And we're not quite there yet. I think everyone would agree with that. And I think there's a lot of people out there quite not sure what to do with these things. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are behind these tools also struggling to understand how they're going to land and how they're going to work. But what do you think, you know, in the next 12 to 24 months, that AI is going to enable us to do in our industry that we couldn't do before?
What I hope, and I see some products getting closer to this, I'm not going to name drop any because those aren't endorsements, but that we're actually going to decode how people learn in a digital environment, what actually works and what doesn't work, because we're going to be able to aggregate and triangulate disparate points of learning combined with outcomes and environmental data to really see if what we think works in how we design content actually does. So to give you an example, when you go to AI, build me a course, and I'm using AI as a general, okay? Build me a course on this. It's going to build you what it thinks is a course, what it's been taught as a course, right? So it's gonna start out with some learning objectives, it's gonna break it down, it's going to, you know, chunk out the information, it's maybe gonna give you a couple of self-check questions to see where you are, et cetera. So it's gonna build that. And that has been the paradigm of how we felt people learn. And when we see a textbook, that's how it's structured. Essentially, a lot of our e-learning can be textbooks on screen. But is that really the best? I would love to somebody to do an A-B test to see, do you actually need learning objectives at the beginning of every module? Or have we wasted how many gigabytes of power just putting that in? That to me is the really exciting way where we find the better ways that people learn, and can we adapt learning to those better ways that are going to make it easier, or I don't want to use easier because easier I think connotates that learning is easy and it's not, but are we going to find better ways to make those pathways work? Because a lot of our digital is based on analog thinking of how we think people learn. That's what really excites me.
I'll agree with that. I think in the short term, a lot of the workflow productivity stuff that we're kind of tackling already, the kind of easy, quick wins, they're going to get saturated at some point. And, you know, so we'll use all the content authoring tools and aggregation and understanding your catalog and heat maps for skills and inferring skills more quickly. The stuff that used to take man hours and a crew of seven rather than just one person with a SaaS product to produce a video. So I think that's great. And it will create the space, this kind of idea that AI will take care of the more menial tasks so that we can have space for the more creative, adventurous kind of exploration and that kind of thinking. I think from the end user learner perspective, the idea of this scalable hyper-personalization, I think, is going to actually become more of a reality. And we experience this today already. If any of us are early adopters of things like ChatGPT, you know, or all these other tools like Claude, et cetera, you really can see the power and potential of these tools on an individual consumer kind of a hobby basis. But I think if you start to implement those ideas and educate your learner population on how to use these tools better, you will start to achieve that hyper-personalization. So I actually wonder if there is a future where we no longer need, you know, aggregated content libraries from licensed providers. And they've got to be scratching their heads thinking, well, what does that mean for us?
Definitely. And a lot of those are in SCORM files that can't be scraped, although there's many working on that problem. And that's almost like the cure for cancer in the edtech space, right? Who can crack that first? Because there's a lot of content locked in there. But then there's also issues around, you know, licensing and who owns that content and can it be repurposed? If I'm a content provider, would I allow my content to be sucked into that to be then sucked into an LLM if I can't control the output, right? And I haven't had a SME review that. So there's a ton of questions there, but definitely an exciting space. And that whole hyper-personalization, I think what comes into that is memory is incredibly hard right now for AI. Even in personal use, it remembers some things, forgets others, no matter how many times you tell it. Although I did get a recent one where it just said, "My answer is concise with no small talk, Lori." And I was like, you get me. I felt like it was a love letter. I was like, wow, you can't remember to stop using M dashes, but you remember that about me. So, but memory is the issue. And I think also, you know, data privacy, if we're using things at work, how much is it actually tracking about you and remembering about you? Those are some landmines that we could step into. But if I want a hyper-personalized experience, I have to give up some of that data.
As I said, hyper-personalization, I almost kind of hesitated because that's kind of a topic that can be a bit polarizing in the kind of L&D practice, right? I do think that there is a place for it in the future. But I think looking beyond, you know, so still, you've got this kind of siloed thinking, even in the things that I've said, which is hyper-personalization in learning. But I'm looking also forward to a future, and this is now kind of gazing into the stars on the potential of things, but learning and development and knowledge transfer is still kind of treated separately with digital adoption and tools and knowledge management and compliance and risk. They all have their kind of separate kind of ecosystems and frameworks for doing things. But actually, in the world of agentic AI, I think a lot of these things will start to have the opportunity to merge together. And I think what that means for employees in the corporate setting is I don't have to go into separate interfaces and user experiences. I don't have to be assigned a thing and, you know, have to kind of tick the box that says I've read the document or the policy or the procedure. I think you're now getting much closer to how is this impacting my performance, my ability to kind of prevent quality kind of deviations. You know, how does it impact business results much more quickly? So I know this is kind of speculative, gazing into the stars, but I think there's real potential for us to be able to get there.
I totally agree, Carlo. And like, you know, I want to believe, you know. The thing that I worry about, and I'd be curious to know your thoughts, because you're in a very regulated industry. I work with a lot of clients who are regulated. Those NASBA requirements or CP requirements, PD requirements, wherever in the world you what you call them, those regulatory bodies are throttling the ability, I think, to do a lot of those things. And it's so frustrating. I get why they're there, but it kind of comes down to L&D is not your legal department. We're not your cheap lawyer who just, you know, rubber stamps everything.
This is where organizations and regulating bodies often come into a bit of friction. And I don't know what the answer is. But if we think about businesses and regulators in partnership to protect the consumer, there's actually common ground, right? I'll think back to my time in financial services where, you know, a lot of things about kind of money laundering sanctions and being able to comply with those kinds of requirements. I think we got to a point where we were partnering, and again, this might be contentious, but we were partnering with regulators to understand how do we address the risk, the real risks, not just the kind of, can we tick the boxes that we've done the thing that you've asked us to do, but really the shared risk that we take on board and that you're trying to protect consumers from, how do we actually impact the outcomes of that? And I think in that partnership and in that conversation, you can bring both parties along in the journey so that not one is left behind, stuck in the old ways of, you know, tick box exercise. We've done our part. You've done your part. If something bad happens down the road, we're protected. But actually, that's not the desired effect of all of this regulation to begin with.
Completely. I mean, we used to have, I go back to my banking days, people, you know, who were not even front-facing had to learn, you know, the elements of a check to look for if it was fraudulent. Why? I was a teller back in the day, but I'm not doing it now. And you're not going to let me walk into your vault and take out money. So why are we doing this?
And I think it goes back to that topic of hyper-personalization, right? I think there is a, depending on your risk appetite, you end up kind of bombarding and carpet bombing your entire population with that kind of stuff when it actually doesn't take the right amount of, you know, it's not purposeful enough and intentional in terms of who you get this learning to. It's got to be good quality learning in the first place for you to be able to influence behavior or impact results. But equally, you don't want that kind of, you know, showering people that don't actually need to do anything with it. And it's not a transaction that they support or a skill that they need, right?
I'm going to get a bang the controversial button on a couple of questions now, just in terms of some of the challenges and risks and get your thoughts. You touched on the fact that, I think, Laurie, you mentioned it around, there's a lot of thinking going on with certain parts of our industry, certainly in the content world. And you said that, you know, in terms of how they want to play nicely with AI or whether they don't want to play nicely at all for the licensing and the future of their business, are they in trouble?
Yes, completely. I think we will laugh, you know, when we look back, it'll be akin to like disco and shoulder pads. When we look back and, although I think shoulder pads are back in, don't scrap that one in the edits. But the idea that we all sat through the same course and we click next to continue, that we lockstepped modules, that you had things in that static environment, I think will be seen as very archaic. And any content provider, I do think there's a need for good content sources. I do think there's a need to harness that knowledge in a way that is consumable. I think all of those things are very important, but content does not equal upskilling. We know that content consumed does not equal upskilling. So we've got also, too, that whole green space of how are they actually applying it? How are they using it? How are they discussing it? How are they teaching it back? How are they being coached on it? And that's always been, before AI, that's always, to me, been the problem with a lot of these content libraries is they were just a buffet that you could serve whatever you pick whatever you want. And, you know, hopefully there's a sneeze guard on it. So that needs, that's all, it's already was on shaky ground. But now, even more so, there will be a real lack of why would I go into a content library that I can't search, that I can't get to the exact piece of content that I need. I can't, it's not going to be personalized to me. I can't make it contextual to what I'm doing and I can't do any practice with it. Why do I have it? So as we see more of the future, the smart ones are going to be the ones that are going to find ways around this, that are going to allow their content to be ingested, that are going to work with those parameters to let people really dive in and get their hands messy in the content, accepting that there will be, you know, some blips. But, you know, at the end of the day, we accept just because content is in a scorm box that it is correct and right. And that's not true either. Like, let's be honest, things get out of date, who reviewed it, all that sort of stuff. I would love to see the death of the traditional, like ever like the sheep dip, I think, Carl, you said carpet bombing, you know, course that, you know, everybody takes.
That, and Laurie, that's why I love speaking to you, because I gave you a yes, no, and you went yes. So I appreciate the honest answer, really, and the backup. So thank you very much. But it doesn't mean Carlo gets away with it either. So I'm going to come to him next in terms of what he thinks.
So interesting one. I think it's a yes, it's going to be a problem for them if they don't get involved early. So I do see the classic content providers starting to explore, experiment, and get involved early. And I think that's a good thing. There's another part to this to tackle, which is content is a bit like something we can learn from the kind of other sectors like entertainment and media. It's all about IP and monetizing IP. You've got a factory that's producing content for you, whether it's book summaries or courses or kind of short form video content and things like that. And you have to be able to monetize that. And the usual approach is around license-based subscriptions and or, you know, pay as you go. I don't know how that's going to change in the future, but the fact that they are trying to explore and experiment with AI capabilities and how that might uplift the service that they provide and the content libraries that they are making available to customers is a good direction to go. They can't stand still. And I do think that the kind of more static old school libraries where it's still kind of search the catalog, do some filtering, and then hope for the best, that's going to go away. The ones that are going to be able to leverage AI capabilities in the right way, listening to their customers, and more importantly, listening to learners, being able to integrate that into wider ecosystems are I think, the ones that are going to be more successful.
I agree. And I think we've actually seen this in the higher ed space with Pearson. When ChatGPT dropped, so did their share price, because they have all the books, they have all the courses, and there is no one faster at ingenuity than a student in university with an overnight deadline of an essay due the next morning. So they were just automatically going to ChatGPT, and that was, or wherever they were going, you know, Claude or wherever, and using that. And so what was the need for Pearson? And they pivoted very quickly, very early. So I would advise having a look at that if anyone listening is interested. Theirs was a different use case, because higher ed is very different from corporate, but they did see that that change coming, and they definitely went after it fast.
We have come to the end of part one of our first episode of L&D Uncovered. Join us next time where we'll do part two on AI. We hope you enjoyed it as we did, and please subscribe and share and help spread the word if you did. We'll be back very soon with part two, but many thanks to Laurie over there in Toronto and Carlo down there in London for all their insights. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.